The headlines: Israeli forces demolish more Palestinian structures near the occupied Al-Quds despite international outcry. The UK's Prime Minister is announcing new proposals to clamp down on protests by giving police more power to prevent disruptions. And Nepal is reeling from a plane crash on Sunday that killed nearly 70 people as local rescue teams continue search operations. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Israeli forces demolished several Palestinian-owned shops in the occupied West Bank as the regime pushes its land grab policy in the Palestinian territories. The latest demolitions took place in the town of Hizma, northeast of Al-Quds. The shops were located near a military checkpoint. Israel also razed 10 Palestinian-owned workshops in the area a year ago. The regime routinely destroys Palestinian property for lacking Israeli construction permits. Palestinians, however, say this is a pretext to seize their lands to allow the regime to expand its illegal settlements. A Saudi academic is on death row for using social media as the Arab monarchy is tightening its grip on dissidents. Prominent pro-reform law professor Awad al-Karni was arrested in September 2017 as part of a campaign of arrests that included at least 20 people. This alleged charges include owning Twitter accounts and using WhatsApp to spread messages deemed hostile to the kingdom. Human rights advocates are warning that the regime is engaged in a new crackdown on free thinkers. That is while the Saudi government and state-controlled investors are raising their financial stakes in U.S. platforms like Twitter and Facebook. The use of social media has been criminalized within the country since the beginning of Mohammed bin Salman's reign. We asked writer and political analyst Saeed Shahabi for his take on the Saudi crackdown on dissidents.
Nobody can say anything in Saudi Arabia, especially against the monarchy, against the Al Saud, the House of Saud. This is number one. Number two, they have the money and they think that by buying those big outlets, they will be able to silence the opposition. Number three, they are very harsh when dealing with anyone standing in their own way. Only 2 weeks ago, or less than that, we commemorated the martyrdom of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, who was executed by the regime in 2015 because of his outspoken criticism of the regime. Only today and yesterday, we were mourning, and we have been mourning the martyrdom of three Bahrainis who were also executed 4 years ago because of opposing the regime.
The Western military alliance NATO has hinted about providing more heavy weapons to Ukrainian in the near future. The NATO Secretary General said new military aid is expected following Kiev's request to its allies for vehicles, artillery and missiles. Jens Stoltenberg was quoted as saying ahead of a meeting this week of a group that coordinates arms supplies to Kiev on Saturday, the UK also pledged to supply main battle tanks to Ukraine. Russia has time and again warned Western governments against their policies. Recently, a top Russian secretary official said the events in Ukraine are not a clash between Moscow and Kiev, but a military confrontation between Russia and NATO. The West, the U.S. in particular, have provided Kiev with billions of dollars of arms and military equipment since the start of the war in 2022. Belarus and Russia have staged joint military drills amid fears of further escalation of fighting in Ukraine. The defense ministry in Minsk says forces have started joint tactical fights with Russia on Belarusian territory. The ministry says all military airfields in Brussels are involved in Belarus, that is, are involved in the maneuvers. The country says that the drills are defensive, stressing that They will not join Russia's war in Ukraine. This comes as Kiev and its Western allies are concerned about the recent flurry of military activity in Belarus. They fear that Russia could use the country to launch a new offensive against Ukraine. Sweden takes over the rotating presidency of the European Union with a vow to oppose Russia and support Ukraine. Critics say the EU foreign policy towards Moscow is set to backfire even further during 2023. Jerome Hughes reports.
Stockholm's government has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union. It holds the position for the next 6 months and faces many challenges. Amid the conflict in Ukraine, the powers that be in Moscow have been singled out.
This is the peaceful order that the Putin regime now seeks to destroy. But we will defend it here and in Ukraine and everywhere.
Many analysts say the EU has shot itself in the foot by provoking and isolating Russia at Washington's behest. Accommodation, food and energy prices remain extremely high in the EU. The European Parliament has just published results of a survey which shows cost of living is the number one concern for citizens. The EU has sent €50 billion to Ukraine during the past 10 months, mostly to provide deadly weapons. Critics say the West wants to feed the arms industry and then make huge profits for Western companies when it finally comes to picking up the pieces.
We are preparing for Ukraine's reconstruction. The international donors platform that we set up with our G7 partners will be up and running this month.
Anti-war activists say many problems could have been averted if Moscow's security concerns had been listened to by NATO and the EU. Tourism industry representatives are asking the European Commission to intervene because in some EU countries, one third of all rooms being offered by hotels and guest houses are currently being occupied by Ukrainian refugees. There's concern the bloc's tourism sector will be decimated this summer if the issue is not resolved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now, the British government is set to put forth a new proposals to quell public protests by giving police more power to prevent serious disruption. The government passed legislation to address the issue last year, but it is planning to go further with a new set of laws known as the Public Order Bill, which is being debated in Parliament. The government wants to amend the bill before it becomes law. That is in order to broaden the power of police to deal with demonstrators who block traffic or lock themselves to objects or buildings. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has defended the new proposal, saying protests by a small minority should not affect other citizens. Civil rights groups have, however, warned that the legislation would be against democracy if passed by Parliament. Rescue teams at the site of a plane crash in Nepal are racing against time to find possible survivors as the country observes a day of national mourning. A senior local official says the chances of finding survivors are now nil. The official, however, says search is underway to find four people who remain missing. That after 68 bodies were pulled from the wreckage of the aircraft and both of its black boxes were recovered. The aircraft had 72 people on board. It hit a hillside near the western city of Pokhara on Sunday. The incident is the deadliest of its kind in Nepal since 1992, when two deadly air crashes killed a total of 280 people. The world's richest people have grabbed nearly two-thirds of the new wealth created since 2020. This is based on a new report by the UK-based charity Oxfam, which is warning of an explosion of inequality. Oxfam says the world's top 1% bagged nearly twice as much new wealth as the rest of the world over the past 2 years. The charity says billionaire fortunes are now swelling by $2.7 billion a day. That is while many are struggling to make a living and tens of millions face hunger. Oxfam says the way forward is taxing at rates that redistribute wealth and reduce extreme inequality. The charity says 5% tax on rich should be enough to lift 2 billion people out of poverty. The mayor of the U.S. city of New York has traveled to the Mexican border of El Paso as part of the efforts to stop the influx of migrants towards the United States' eastern borders. Eric Adams said, quote, "There is no room in New York for busloads of migrants being sent to America's most populous city." He criticized the administration of President Joe Biden for its response to the migrants' influx, saying, "Now is the time for the government to do its job." Busloads of migrants have been shipped north to New York and other U.S. cities. That has exacerbated the housing crisis in the city. Adams says the migrant influx into New York could cost the city as much as $2 billion. The killing of African Americans by U.S. law enforcement officers continues unabated. This time, an unarmed black man falls victim to U.S. police brutality in the state of California. Keenan Darnell Anderson's death happens in the early days of 2023, making it one of the deadliest New Year holidays for people of color. This assumes potentiality that 2023 is likely to be the deadliest year for minorities in America.
Get on the street!
The United States and yet again, racially motivated killings happening on a record number. The tragic death of Keenan Darnell Anderson after he was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident has sparked outrage. Anderson, 31, cousin of the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, Patrice Cullors, died at a hospital in Santa Monica, California, after suffering a cardiac arrest following the crash on the afternoon of January 3rd in a Los Angeles neighborhood. Anderson was repeatedly tased by Los Angeles police officers and restrained following the accident. In a 13-minute body cam footage released by Los Angeles Police Department, Anderson is seen begging for help as multiple officers hold him to the ground and one officer presses his elbow along with his body weight onto his neck.
Your time is just
stopping. Stop it, I'm gonna tase you. Okay, stop it, I'm gonna tase you. Stop it, I'm gonna tase you.
Then Anderson can be heard, "They're trying to George Floyd me," referring to African-American man George Floyd, who was killed at the hands of the U.S. police in May 2020 in Minneapolis, sparking racial justice protests around the world. In the footage, Anderson shouts, "They're trying to kill me," asking others for help. After the incident, paramedics arrived at the scene and took him to a hospital, where according to the police, he went into cardiac arrest, which caused his death. Now, Patrice Cullors, who herself co-founded the Black Lives Matter movement, says her cousin was asking for help and he didn't receive it. She said he was killed, adding that nobody deserves to die in fear, panicking and scared for their life. Cullors noted her cousin was scared for his life, stressing that he spent the last 10 years witnessing a movement challenging the killing of black people. He knew what was at stake and he was trying to protect himself. Nobody was willing to protect him. Anderson's killing is the third such incident linked to the Los Angeles police in the first days of 2023. On January 2nd, police fatally shot 45-year-old Tucker Smith, and a day after, police fired on a 35-year-old Oscar Sanchez. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has called the incidents deeply disturbing, adding that we must reduce the use of force overall, and I have absolutely no tolerance for excessive force. The latest police violence highlights alarming proportions in the U.S. in recent years, with people of color being the main targets. A 2021 study recorded 30,800 deaths from the police violence across the U.S. between 1980 and 2018, far higher than estimates offered by the National Vital Statistics System. The study said more than 55 deaths of such incidents in the U.S. from 1980 to 2018 were misclassified or unreported in official vital statistics reports. Meanwhile, according to new data released earlier this month, U.S. police killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the country since experts first started tracking the killings.
One point to be taken into consideration is the fact that many such killings by the U.S. police could be prevented. In the case of Keenan Darnell Anderson, the Black Lives Matter movement argues that if black officers were dispatched to areas where such incidents happen, the number of fatalities will sharply decrease.
The killing of Keenan Darnell Anderson takes numerous matters into the spotlight. First and foremost is how U.S. officials reacted to the incident. 31-year-old father and English teacher, who is an African-American, killed by LAPD police. to cause cardiac arrest after being repeatedly tased by the police. Anderson is the cousin of Black Lives Matter movement Patrice Cullors, but still no major word or reaction from anyone within the establishment. 2. Could this death by any means be prevented? Cullors say this was a traffic accident. Instead of treating Anderson like a potential criminal, police could have called the ambulance. If there was a policy in which traffic stops were met with unarmed professionals who come to the scene to help with whatever situation has happened, that would have prevented my cousin's death, and that would have prevented so many other deaths. The other matter that has to be taken into account is how he was killed. One officer had his elbow on Anderson's neck while he was lying down before another tased him for roughly 30 seconds straight before pausing and tasing him again for 5 more seconds. The other point is LAPD not calling it a killing. It instead calls it an in-custody death. Apart from the ambiguity of the phrase, Keene was tased to death, everyone knows LAPD caused Keenan's death. Cullors say these types of killing and this type of force will not be interrupted unless we have courageous elected officials come forward and challenge not just the police, but also the policies. One other factor is that the incident marks the third officer-involved death in the city this year. From 1980 to 2018, more than 30,000 people have died by police violence in the United States, according to a 22 article published in The Lancet. U.S. police killing 3 people a day, and no progress since George Floyd. Based on figures released by Mapping Police Violence, police have killed roughly 1,100 people each year since 2013. In 2021, officers killed 1,136 people, one of the deadliest years on record. National data has shown that roughly 10% of the killings by police each year starts with a traffic encounter, and that 1 in 3 people killed were fleeing before lethal force was used. What about police brutality and racial bias? Why are there more cases of police brutality against African Americans or people of color than whites? By one estimate, black people are 2.5 times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. In another study, black people who were fatally shot by police seem to be twice as likely as white people to be unarmed. Based on information from more than 2 million 911 calls in 2 U.S. cities, it can be concluded that white officers dispatched to black neighborhoods fired their guns 5 times as often as black officers dispatched for similar calls to the same neighborhoods. The Washington Post reports lawsuits to settle allegations of misconduct by more than 7,600 officers from around the country have amounted to more than $3.2 billion over the past decade. All in all, what seems to be a very high urgency is that U.S. police treatment of African Americans needs an overhaul. If not, more and more people like Keenan Darnell Anderson will fall victim to the U.S. police brutality, and officers involved killing will be sharply on the rise.
And now, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4th, 2023. I'm hopeful that the issues that are discussing about women, and I can see that, praise God, you and the women who spoke today are well versed on these issues. People like you should repeat these things and talk about them. I'm hopeful that you will also be able to have an impact on the public opinion of those in the West, because their women are truly suffering. The female community in the West today is suffering unconsciously in some cases and consciously in other cases. You may have an impact on them as well. One of the points that I would like to talk about today is Islam's viewpoints with regard to gender and the issue of women. That is, what is Islam's view on the issue of men and women? I will talk about this briefly and leave it up to you to research and delve into the topic further for more clarification.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Regarding the Islamic viewpoint, it can be said that Islam sees individuals as human beings when it evaluates them on the basis of Islam and as a person. Men and women have no priority over one another. They are not different in this. The equality of men and women in terms of human and Islamic values is one of the clear principles of Islam. There is no doubt about this. In the continuation of the verses that were recited here, there is a verse in the Holy Quran that states, "Indeed, the Muslim men and the Muslim women, the faithful men and the faithful women, the obedient men and the obedient women, the truthful men and the truthful women, the patient men and the patient women, humble men and the humble women, the charitable men and the charitable women, the men who fast and the women who fast, the men who guard their private parts and the women who guard, the men who remember Allah greatly, and the women who remember Allah greatly. Allah holds in store for them forgiveness and a great reward. The Holy Quran, chapter 33, ayah 35. This is Islam's view.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Oxfam report analyzed 1,727 attacks on Yemeni civilians since the start of 2021. The report finds that at least 839 civilians were killed and 1,775 others were wounded during this time. 87 of the deaths were caused by airstrikes alone. The aircrafts used in the attacks, over half of them British-made, used cluster bombs, the use of which is banned by international law. The rest of the killings were done through artillery strikes, missile barrages, drone attacks, landmines, road bombs, and the use of light arms. According to another report by an American think tank, The American Thinker, Saudi Arabia spends some $200 million per day on the war to hire mercenaries and maintain the arms supply. A large portion of this money goes to the UK for purchasing Typhoon and Tornado aircrafts, Paveway bombs and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles, making the UK fully complicit in the crimes committed against Yemeni civilians. As stated by the International Development Committee of the UK, given that the UK has a long history of defense exports to Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners, and considering the evidence we have heard, it seems inevitable that any violations of international humanitarian and human rights law by the coalition have involved arms supplied from the UK. These arms have also been used by the Saudi-led coalition to bomb health facilities on 19 separate instances, which constitutes war crimes. Oxfam's policy advisor Martin Butcher called on the UK government to immediately cease its arms sales to the Saudis. He also pointed out the hypocrisy of UK sanctions against Russia over alleged war crimes in Ukraine, all the while turning a blind eye to the blatant war crimes of the Saudi coalition in Yemen. Not only that, but he also pointed out to the fact that the UK government still continues to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, being its second biggest arms supplier, which will be inevitably used in the war against Yemen. Butcher also said they, the government, have really been not only arming Saudi Arabia, but also very reluctant to use their position in the Security Council to push for peace. Saudi Arabia is the biggest importer of arms in the world, second only to a country with 40 times the population. In the year 2020 alone, the kingdom imported nearly $1 billion worth of arms, the majority of which came from the US. This, however, does not stop the US from parroting a tired narrative of pushing for peace in Yemen, when they even hesitate to call it a war. This is apparent by Biden's initial pledges to end the war during his presidential campaign while still supplying arms to the kingdom to this day. Here's Timothy Lender King, U.S. Special Envoy to Yemen.
Let me begin first by reiterating our commitment, the commitment of the United States, to helping improve Yemeni lives, creating the space for Yemenis to collectively determine their own future, and to advance a durable resolution that ends the conflict in Yemen.
All the while, the weapon fragments bearing U.S. and U.K. branding paints a starkly different picture. The 6 months UN-sponsored truce that was supposed to be the grounds for longer-standing solutions was also very quickly and repeatedly violated by Saudi Arabia. This is what Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement sees as the reason for the temporary truce. The Saudi-led coalition's main goal out of the truce was to stop the Houthi Ansarullah forces from carrying out retaliatory military operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia. Moreover, the crippling sea, land, and air blockade on Yemen has created a humanitarian disaster in the country. With all options exhausted, the Ansarullah movement has now said that it will inevitably launch missile strikes deep inside Saudi and UAE territories. This comes amid reports that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is looking to find a way out of the incredibly costly Yemen war. The Lebanese Al-Akhbar newspaper wrote, Riyadh is now showing a lot of flexibility during negotiations. It currently has no concern other than getting security guarantees that strategic facilities deep inside the country would not be hit. It has abandoned the illusion of turning Yemen into a country under its tutelage and has instead sufficed for security assurances. However, this report needs more confirmation. While the Saudi coalition has indeed failed in its attempts to strangle Yemen into submission, their aggression still caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
Since the war broke out in Ukraine and Western countries rushed to help Ukraine against Russia, they provided Ukraine with different types of weapons in a bid to prevent Russia's rapid military advance. But it has now turned out that the war has been a unique opportunity for Western arms manufacturers to make a profit. According to a report based on data from the Defense News and TradingView Analytics, major Western arms manufacturers involved in military supplies to Ukraine earned $124 billion last year. According to estimates, the corporation's combined market capitalization increased from $579 billion in December 2021 to $703 billion in December 2022. The ranking included 25 companies with a capitalization of over $1 billion, which are traded on the stock market and have military products dominating their revenues. These companies are actively involved in arms supplies to Ukraine. German arms manufacturer Rheinmetall has been the top gainer over the last 12 months. Its share price has surged 122%. Another notable example is French drone and missile producer Thales, whose stock value rose by 54%. American military contractor Northrop Grumman was up 44%, and the stock of HIMARS rocket launchers maker Lockheed Martin gained 42%. Other notable mentions in the report include BAE Systems, Kongsberg, Gruppen, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies.
Rather than continuing to build up offensive capability by transferring weapons from the American side to the Ukrainian side, which enriches American defense contractors and only allows more Ukrainians and more Russians to bleed, more and more weapons will eventually lead to an escalation of the war, and that is extremely dangerous.
The report comes amid increasing military support for Ukraine. In 2022, the Biden administration committed more than $19 billion in military aid to Ukraine. It's set to give Ukraine another $45 billion in 2023. Washington is now seeking to deliver Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. The U.S. is now set to train scores of Ukrainian troops on how to deploy and maintain the American Patriot missile systems.
The training will prepare approximately 90 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers to operate, maintain, and sustain the defensive system over a training course expected to last several months. And once fielded, the Patriot will continue to contribute to Ukraine's air defense capabilities and provide another capability to the Ukrainian people to defend themselves against Russia's ongoing aerial assaults.
The Kremlin has said the systems and any crews accompanying them would be legitimate priority targets for the Russian military. The U.S. is now contemplating delivering Stryker armored vehicles to Ukraine as part of a new Pentagon shipment. Furthermore, the U.K. announced that it would provide Ukraine with main battle tanks, and Poland said it would transfer a company of Leopard 2 Panzers to Kiev. Germany has, however, to greenlight Poland's re-export of the hardware. Germany says it will follow the U.S. President Joe Biden's lead on whether to support Kiev with Leopard 2 main battle tanks. Germany has faced mounting pressure to provide Ukraine with Leopard 2 tanks, but has been reluctant to do so. Russia has repeatedly warned Western countries against sending arms to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned the West against flooding Ukraine with weapons. It insists that sending more weapons to Ukraine will only prolong the war, while prompting the Kiev forces to kill civilians in the pro-Moscow regions.
Police in Brazil have detained some 1,500 supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro over attacks on government buildings at the weekend, as calls for justice and accountability grow across the South American nation. Most of the former far-right leader's backers were detained when law enforcement forces dismantled a protest camp in the capital, Brasilia, which many demonstrators set off from on Sunday before breaking into Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidential palace. The administration of Brazil's new left-wing president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was officially sworn in on January 1st, has pledged to investigate those behind the violence and hold them to account. Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, who is running investigations of the anti-democratic protests, vowed in a speech on Tuesday to combat what he called the terrorists at work in Brasilia. Rioters broke windows, toppled furniture, and hurled computers and printers to the ground as they ransacked the government buildings on Sunday. They destroyed precious works of art, overturned the U-shaped table where Supreme Court justices convene, ripped a door off one justice's office, and vandalized a statue outside the court. Lula denounced what he called far-right acts of terrorism as he met the leaders of both houses of Congress and the head of the Supreme Court. He had also blamed Bolsonaro for instigating his supporters after a campaign of baseless allegations about the October election results. Lula has vowed to bring to justice those responsible for what he called the fascist assault and declared federal intervention in public security in the capital lasting until January 31st. The riot came after Lula, who previously served as Brazil's president from 2003 to 2010, narrowly defeated Bolsonaro in a hard-fought presidential election runoff on October 30th. Bolsonaro is a former army captain who has expressed admiration for the military regime that ruled Brazil from 1964 to 1985. For months, he had falsely claimed the country's electronic voting system was vulnerable to fraud. Sunday's riot in Brasilia also drew parallels to the January 6, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol, which saw a mob of former President Donald Trump's supporters storm the legislature in an effort to stop Congress from certifying his successor Joe Biden's election victory. Brazilian police were noticeably slow to react to the riot in Brasilia, even after the arrival of more than 100 buses, leading many to question whether authorities had either simply ignored numerous warnings, underestimated the protesters' strength, or been somehow complicit. Prosecutors in the capital said local security forces were negligent at the very least. In Brazil's capital on Sunday, thousands of protesters attacked government institutions in a dangerous echo of the United States' January 6 insurrection. Bolsonaro, dubbed as Tropical Trump, has questioned the credibility of the country's electronic voting system without providing evidence. Lula was sworn in on January 1st, unleashing a barrage of rebuke against Bolsonaro for what he called his predecessor's mishandling of Brazil's affairs during his mandate. There have been claims of the CIA involvement in what is seen as a failed coup in Brazil. If true, why would the CIA attempt to do so? To be sure, the CIA does have a long track record of staging coups in Latin America, but it has done so with the intent of dismantling leftist governments and installing far-right regimes. Brazil is set to reassert itself in global geopolitics alongside fellow BRICS states Russia, India, and China. Lula at the helm in Brazil, in what is now his third non-successive presidential term, will offer a tremendous boost to BRICS. In the 2000s, Lula was a key conceptualizer of a deeper role for BRICS, including trade in their own currencies. The U.S. is being slowly but surely expelled from wider Eurasia by concerted actions of the Russia-China strategic partnership. Ukraine is a black hole, where NATO faces a humiliation similar to what the U.S. faced in Afghanistan, a feeble EU being forced by Washington to deindustrialize and buy U.S. liquefied natural gas at absurdly high cost as no essential resources for the empire to plunder. Geoeconomically, that leaves the U.S.-denominated Western Hemisphere, especially immense energy-rich Venezuela, as the key target. And geopolitically, the key region actor is Brazil. The U.S. would seemingly try to pull all stops to prevent Chinese and Russian trade expansion and political influence in Latin America, which Washington, irrespective of international law and the concept of sovereignty, continues to call its backyard. U.S. airstrikes in Somalia increased 30% in 2022 as the Biden administration increased U.S. involvement in the Horn of Africa country that is experiencing a new wave of fighting between the government and Al-Shabaab terrorists. In 2022, the Pentagon carried out 15 airstrikes on Al-Shabaab. According to data from the U.S. Africa Command, these strikes resulted in the death of at least 107 terrorists. The U.S. has conducted military operations against Al-Shabaab in Somalia since 2007. AFRICOM estimates the group has 5,000 to 10,000 fighters across the country of 15 million, controlling large swathes of land in southern and central Somalia. On Saturday, Somalia's government claimed for the first time that Al-Shabaab called for open negotiations with the government as it conducts a military offensive against the group it described as a total war. The uptick in fighting between Al-Shabaab and government forces has come as the country experiences a fresh wave of attacks. This shows that the U.S. so-called counterterrorism military operations in Somalia have yielded few results. Despite the U.S. attacks, Al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out attacks in the country. Al-Shabaab recently claimed responsibility for a twin suicide car bombing in Somalia's Hiran region that killed around 20 people. Last year was a particularly bloody one. More than 100 people died in October when two car bombs exploded at a busy Mogadishu intersection. In August, Al-Shabaab launched a days-long siege on a Mogadishu hotel that left more than 20 people dead. In 2020, former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration moved to withdraw all 700 American troops from Somalia after a three-decade presence in the country. Soon after the Biden administration came into office, it reversed the Trump move. And in May 2022, U.S. officials said the president approved a plan to redeploy troops to Somalia. Some U.S. lawmakers have raised concerns about the U.S. military campaign in Somalia, which has been carried out on the grounds of the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, passed following the 9/11 terror attacks. Successive U.S. administrations have used the AUMF as a pretext to approve military action in countries like Afghanistan, Yemen, and Djibouti, despite no formal declaration of war by Congress. In December, Democratic Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs and Senator Elizabeth Warren sent a letter to the Pentagon arguing that the Defense Department was undercounting civilian casualties in Somalia. The U.S. Congress is the branch of the American government that has the authority to declare war. Despite Congress not having declared war in Somalia, the Biden administration has used the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force to bypass restrictions. The 2001 AUMF has been used by successive administrations to justify military operations against a number of groups.
in at least 19 countries, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. Today, the authorization for the use of military force is the legal basis used to justify all current wars. For this reason, it is called the blank check for the endless wars. And while the Biden administration has signaled it supports ending the different 2002 AUMF specifically for Iraq, it has not shown any support for revoking the wider-ranging 2001 AUMF, despite calls from the lawmakers. In August, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin lauded the country's military operations in Africa, saying it works alongside our friends as full partners to strengthen bonds, to tackle common threats, and to advance a shared vision of an Africa whose people are safe and prosperous. But a recent report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies contradicts this. The report says terrorist group violence in Africa has risen inexorably over the past decade, expanding by 300% during this time. The U.S. has spent roughly $2.5 billion on security assistance for Somalia since 2009. It has also conducted at least 265 airstrikes since 2007. However, despite years of military presence in Africa, U.S. has failed to combat extremists and terrorists.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Imam Khomeini's viewpoint on condition of leadership. In Islam, it is the law which rules. The noble prophet, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, was also following the law, the divine law. He was not able to violate it. Addressing the holy prophet, Allah the Exalted says that if you say something against that which I say, I will seize you and cut off your aorta. if the prophet was a director or a person that people were afraid lest he may dictate to them on enjoying the whole power, then a jurist could also be a dictator.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the self-building and combat with the self. In one of his speeches, he mentioned that which is necessary for all of us is to begin with our own soul. We must not be pleased with adjusting or rectifying appearances. Rather, we must start with our hearts, from our brains or minds, and see that each day we are somewhat better than the day before. Now, in this part of his speech, obviously, he's talking about a very important point. Sometimes people, when they change their appearance, they think that they're so spiritual. They think they have become pure. Their soul has achieved the purification, but they never work on purification. They never work on their heart, the feelings that they have, the thoughts that they have, the beliefs that they have. If we want the purification of the soul, we need to purify our beliefs. When we believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it should be a pure believing in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The belief on the day of judgment, the belief that we need to perform good deeds. It is the soul which is the actual thing. It's not the appearance. Yes, appearances is important because it should be in line with the goal that we want to achieve. We cannot say like, for example, my soul is pure, so I don't need a hijab. Sometimes like we hear these things that they say it should be the heart of a person which should be the clean. The appearance is not important. Yes, appearance is important because when heart is pure, the heart is giving an order to my body that, look, if I want to be pure, if I want to remain pure, it is necessary that you need to make your appearance, which should be in line with this purification. This pure heart tells me to have the hijab. This pure heart tells me to not to backbite. This pure heart tells me not to accuse people wrongly. This heart tells me not to belay people. This heart tells me not to oppress people. So all these things, the appearances that I have, it should be in line with the soul. Therefore, the soul is important. The soul is very important. And if someone, sometimes we see like they change their appearance and they think they have become pure, this is not the way. The appearance itself does not help. Yes, it helps a bit that it takes you one step ahead. But if you want to have the purification, then obviously you need to work on your soul. And that's what Imam Khomeini is saying, that you need to work on your heart, from your brain, your mind, and then become pure, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, and we shall also look at, in the backdrop of tumultuous Sino-India relations and border tensions, China's recent interest in rebooting relations with India. We will discuss BJP government in New Delhi formalizing new rules to change the demography of the Muslim-majority state of Jammu and Kashmir.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi recently stated that Beijing is willing to work with India to improve bilateral ties, extending an olive branch to the regional foe. His remarks suggest China wants to reset its ties with India. Wang's Indian counterpart, on the other hand, has maintained that the status of the relationship between the two countries will depend on the state of the border. S.J. Shankar noted that relations between the two sides are going through a difficult phase.
India-China relations continue to remain at odds. India's Foreign Minister S.J. Shankar has on many occasions mentioned the state of problematic relations between the two countries. He believes that the two countries need mutual sensitivity, mutual respect, and mutual interest to restore normal diplomatic ties. His Chinese counterpart, on the other hand, looks more optimistic and has offered to open a new chapter in bilateral ties. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi earlier this week said that both countries have maintained communication through diplomatic and military channels, and both are committed to upholding the stability in the disputed border region. He expressed China's desire to work with India in the direction towards steady and sound growth of China-India relations. The statement came amid heightened tensions after paramilitary forces of the two countries clashed near Tawang in the northeastern Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh last month. Even though the situation was brought under control, the truth is that after the Galwan clash in 2020, the forces of the two countries showed no sign of pulling back. It remains to be seen if the Chinese Foreign Minister's statement will change anything on the ground or if the status quo will remain intact.
The India-China border clashes in recent years have been the worst in over half a century, bringing the relationship between the two countries to an all-time low. While India is working to deepen its cooperation with the US, Beijing is hoping New Delhi might retrace its old antipathy towards the West and abstain from moving closer to the US in particular. China has maintained that it will not be subdued by hegemonic powers and their bullying tactics, calling on New Delhi to join the Eastern Bloc.
Sino-India relations have hit the rock bottom in the last few years. The two Asian giants have been involved in military skirmishes along the disputed borders in Ladakh and Arunachal Pradesh on several occasions. More recently, a video emerged online of what appeared to be a previously unreported violent clash between the two armies. The video was reportedly filmed in the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh at the line of actual control, the de facto border between the two countries. The growing India-US bonhomie has not also been taken well by China. In a recent speech by the Chinese foreign minister while taking stock of China's foreign policy during the year 2022, he primarily focused on China's troubled relationship with the U.S. Wang Yi, while lashing out at the U.S., pointed to its relations with China as erroneous policy. China has also not been happy with India's membership in the U.S.-led quadrilateral security dialogue. The Quad, comprising the U.S., India, Japan, and Australia, often referred to as Asian NATO, is aimed at thwarting the Chinese plans for the Asia-Pacific region. China has maintained that it is focusing on strategic stability in relation to other major countries to make the world a better place.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Chris McRain from Manchester. He's a geopolitical analyst. Mr. McRain, welcome to the program. Now, let's begin with China's recent statement to work with India for better relations between the two countries. How do you see it, especially coming at a time when the two sides recently engaged in clashes near the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh?
I think China's main goal, as it has been for the past 30 years of development, is the progress of a multipolar world. And India is a big part of that. I know they do have a disagreement of a